On today's show, we discuss the news that Facebook and Twitter are moving into video advertising and ask how this will affect the user experience. Also, we'll be chatting about the rise of Google Glass and smartwatches and see how consumers will react. Later on, we'll be talking to sports blogger and editor of Action81.com, Emmett Ryan, about building up a reputation online as well as the benefits of self-publishing. And you're very welcome to the show. We're joined by our regular panelists, community manager Aidan Coughlin and our lead designer Sarah Kavanagh. And starting off with the news that video ads will be making their way onto both Facebook and Twitter in the summertime. In Facebook's case, it's going to be reportedly it's going to be a case that the ads will be capped at 15 seconds. It'll make sure that you won't see any more than 3 ads a day, and it has an asking price of $1 million for anyone that's interested in it. Aidan, if I can start off with you, is it strange that the price tag for this is so high?
No, if you're going to introduce a very, very disruptive form of advertising like this, you want to make sure that at least the quality is very good. Advertisers who have a million to put into just the ad spend, they don't make ads that aren't top quality. I think this is going to be Facebook's way of just ensuring that it's something that people will actually want to watch, and you're talking Super Bowl style ads, something that will become a talking point in its own right.
And like, the demographics are very, very broad at the moment. There's only 4 so far. You're either, it's male or female, above or under 30 years old. Can it go any more specific than that, or does it need to aim very, very broad just to get started off?
No, it'll go much more specific over time. I think, you know, you get 4 primary advertisers in that sense. It gets people talking. Everyone sees a different ad, of course, so there's a bit of dialogue created there. Perhaps if I was to put on my PR hat, which is purely figurative, I would say that this gets conversation away from how annoying these disruptive ads are and onto things like, oh, this is the one I see and this is the one you see. What's the one you see like? And so it moves the conversation away from this radical change.
Yeah, and I was going to mention about the kind of user experience as well. Like, a lot of them are going to be autoplays. Well, in Facebook's case, we don't know what the story is with Twitter, but is that going to be disruptive, a little bit too disruptive for the newsfeed, considering that Facebook has made a point of making sponsored stories as user-friendly and as seamless as possible?
I hate autoplays and videos. I really do. It really annoys me, especially when, because I work with 20 tabs open at a time, so I've constantly got different sites running and different things happening, and you know, I'm just wondering how this is actually going to happen. You know, is it going to pop into my newsfeed while I'm not actually on the Facebook tab and I'm listening to music, and all of a sudden all I hear is this ad playing in the background? You know, I don't know how that's actually going to play out, but
apparently it's going to be appearing at the sidebar instead of the main newsfeed for
it's
the beginning
going to spread
ones.
Across. So you
I'd imagine
to...
it'll go into the main newsfeed over time.
Okay, so something auto-playing in your sidebar then is even more annoying because it's going to be quite small, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
No, I don't know until I actually see how they're going to roll this out. I can't really...
I think they're going to be more clever than doing something that is really in-your-face obnoxious and puts you off the site altogether. I would imagine they have these things worked out. Also, it's probably going to be quite easy to get around these things. But you know, advertising in a certain sense has to be disruptive. If advertising is too smoothly integrated into user experience, it's not doing its job. A lot of people say to me, "Oh, I don't even look at Facebook ads. I don't even click on Facebook. I never click on Facebook ads." They kind of have to get in your face a little bit. Now, I'm talking as a marketer here, not as a user.
And it's funny because a lot of people say, "Oh, I never click on it," yet they generate billions of dollars from it, implying that many people do.
They do. I mean, I see it every single day in my job. I see the numbers of people who've seen it, and I see the number of people who've clicked on it, and they're much bigger than you think. So a lot of people don't click on them. A hell of a lot of people do. However, the fact is they're becoming very much integrated into the newsfeed, into the furniture around Facebook, and they're not capturing attention anymore.
And I guess the more interesting, you know, aspect, although Facebook would be kind of the headline grabber, would be Twitter introducing video ads as well. Are either of you any idea like how you would see those ads working? Would there be something similar to, say, Vine, like 6-second snippets, or do you think they'd actually, you know, go the same route, like make them a little bit longer or more comprehensive?
I love the idea. I've always loved the idea of Vine. I've said that several times on the blog and the podcast, whatever. But I love the form of that Vine videos take. It's quick, it's snappy, it's over before you even have the chance to get your mouse up to click stop. And I think people like a message being put across in such a short and snappy fashion. It's a mini blitz. I think it's the best way to do this sort of thing. If you're going to annoy people, annoy them for a really short time and they'll get over it in an equally short time.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the shorter, the better, especially the form that Twitter takes. Everything is short and snappy, so it wouldn't make sense to have anything long and drawn out. Even if it is only 15 seconds, I think that's too long for Twitter. And plus, the amount of content that you're absorbing so quickly on Twitter as well is another thing to take into consideration. You know, you just scroll through your feed.
Yeah.
So it has to be something that's going to be snappy and fast and punchy and that you're not going to actually want to skip over. I don't know how they're going to get around that, whether they're going to have it, again, in the kind of the sidebar under trends, or whether or not it's actually going to feature in the main.
Well, there's a lot of potential for what they can do with the service, isn't
there?
Yeah,
but given the way Twitter is used, it's going to be primarily geared at mobile users eventually, ultimately, and it is going to show up probably in line with the feed.
Yeah.
But, you know, you skip straight on past that, you know, like you do with a Vine video. But I think the really clever, the good marketers are going to rise to the top here, because we're going to see people who are assembling messages that are delivered within 2 or 3 seconds. And like I said, before you even have time to stop the video, before you even have time to scroll past, they've already got their message out to you. And I think that's something that I'd be, you know, I'm quite excited to see.
Yeah, what was that movie a couple of weeks ago that it was like the first movie trailer on Vine?
I wonder if
that was a test for this.
Possibly.
Because that got a lot of traction. A lot of people were talking about it. And, you know, you'd wonder whether or not, like, their ad spend.
Twitter has been such a massive success is because people love the idea of getting a message across in a very short period of time. I've said this about Vine being a good idea for the very same reason. If marketers can capitalize on it, well, if that is the form that Twitter advertising takes, if it takes something else, then I'm not quite as keen and I'm not quite as on board.
So moving on from potentially smart ideas to potentially smart devices, the last 2 months have been filled not only with talk of Google Glass, but also about smartwatches reportedly being developed by the likes of Apple, Samsung, and now Microsoft. I'm going to start off with the ideas of smartwatches first. Aidan, where's this sudden interest coming from? Because this idea has been tried before and it wasn't successful. So what happened?
I think you just hit the nail on the head. It's the idea we've always wanted to realise right from the days when people, you know, the coolest kid in school had the self-declared coolest kid in school had a calculator on his watch or a remote control TV on his watch. You know, you had both those things, didn't you?
I can neither confirm nor deny those allegations.
Well, I certainly did. I had a touchscreen watch at one point, and it could store phone numbers, and it was the cool. And you know what it was? Before smartphones and before iPads and tablets and laptops that went everywhere with you, this was such a brilliant idea, because the watch was the one thing you had with you all the time, before we got used to having other things with us all the time. And for that very reason, I think this is the realization. We're finally able to do what we've been trying to do for a long time. This is our second man on the moon moment. This is a realization of our technological aspirations over a long period of time. They're not going to work as self-contained devices. I think they're going to integrate with other devices, whether that's cross-brand or single brand, I don't know. It might be somewhere where you can read a text, where you could, you know, if you're walking along listening to music, you don't want to have to dig your phone out of your pocket with your headphones, pulling all the receipts out along with them and all that sort of thing. You can just read it on your watch. It's another platform to integrate things on, and I think it's a fantastic idea. I'm really very excited about it.
I'm
going to say that just to clarify, I did not have a smartwatch or anything like that, but I always loved the idea of having one, because I remember watching cartoons like James Bond Jr. where they'd be talking to somebody, you know,
the
headquarters. Oh yeah, Power Rangers as well. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, being told like to hack into the mainframe, you know, through a watch was always like kind of a childhood dream. But I don't know whether I can do that now or not. Maybe that's a career change for another day. But
I never had a touchscreen watch ever, or even a digital watch. I'm an analog person when it comes to
really
watches.
I can't read analog. I stare at it for a couple of minutes and I have to consciously think, where's the big hand, where's the little hand, what does it all mean? My touchscreen watch, it costs £54.99 in Argos in 1998.
I probably shouldn't have said Argos.
it was Casio. It was pretty classy stuff. And really, it was back then, though. I just felt like the world was just all integrated. I was able to keep phone numbers on there. I was able to do all these things. I can't remember what else now, apart from phone numbers. But to have that again, to have that functionality on your wrist all day, every day, is something that I think we've been needing to return to for a long time.
I personally think they're going to turn into very expensive remote controls
I was going to say that because in school you'd always come across a person who had the remote control watch and they'd be changing the channels every night.
If you think what these are going to be used for, right, ideally they're going to be used to integrate with either your phone, as Aidan said, or something like Google Glass, where, okay, you don't want to be like putting your hand up to your head to interact with this Google Glass device. So it's obviously going to have to be controlled in some way. And you don't want to be talking away to yourself like a lunatic walking down the street all the time, especially in Dublin. So, you know, if Microsoft go ahead and develop one of these, or Google go and develop their own kind of watch, I think it's very much going to act as a remote control for the other wearable gadget that you're using.
I don't know if I'd say a remote control. I'd say...
Well, I think it's going to be very functional.
Yeah, but partially a remote control, partially a second screen.
And
think between those two uses. Now, it's going to depend on the price tag, you know, for a lot of people, obviously.
And the size, you know.
Yeah. I was going to ask as well.
And the battery life.
And the style as well.
I couldn't imagine charging my watch every evening. Like, that would kind of get a bit annoying.
Well, it's every four evenings is what they're saying, and it'll probably come with a little thing that you can stick it on beside your bed. And, oh my God, I can't wait. Screw the price tag, I just signed me up.
I was going to say, though, will it be a case, you know, price tag aside, will it be a case of style over functionality or functionality over style? Because I personally love the idea of Google Glass. I have to differ between everyone else. But at the same time, I can see myself being very self-conscious of the fact that I'm wearing, you know, this very sleek device in my head.
Yeah, like, you wouldn't be walking around parts of Dublin wearing those jokes. Like, you'd be mugged, definitely.
Well, at least you'd be able to record the mugging and get the person's face through that. Yeah. That's also an advantage. So, like,
there is that.
Yeah.
They're all suspects.
You can tell I'm really looking forward to Google
Look
Glass.
Look at your two pre-orders already.
But it's like for the average consumer, which do you think would be more successful, a watch or glass?
A watch.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just it's less it's of practical. A leap, I think, for now. I think, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's something we are a bit adjusted to. We're used to wearing things on our wrists that do things. We're used to wearing things on our face. For glasses wearers among us, we're used to wearing things on our face that just serve as glasses. The other thing then is, like, I mean, will Google Glasses be able to... can you get them with a prescription?
Yeah, like, yeah. Or are you going to have to wear them with your glasses?
I'd imagine you'd wear your glasses. You know, it's kind of a...
Visor.
I can't actually. It's a audio...
I wonder how many
medium,
car crashes are going to happen when they come out first from people being distracted by updates on Facebook while they're driving. Potential hazard there. Potential hazard there, Quentin.
Yeah, see, the watch saves lives.
Yeah, see, I'm all on board for the watch. I'm sold.
Well, I can't buy against that logic, and because of that, I'm going to end the show. Okay. Aidan, Sarah, thanks a million for chatting.
Thank you.
Now, moving on, starting up a blog has become easier than ever, but not only does it take time and effort to build up a reputation, you need something to separate you from the rest of the pack. Emmett Ryan is the editor of Action81.com and is best known in Ireland for his GAA column Tactics Not Passion, the subject of which he based his first book upon. I started off by asking him where the idea for his column first came from.
So the basic idea, like, I was at a match in 2010, Dublin were playing Wexford, and it was going a bad way. Dublin eventually came back to win, but what was actually annoying me more wasn't the way Dublin were playing. It's I could actually see what the columns about that game were going to be like, and I just was kind of frustrated because I've been a Gaelic football fan for a long time. And, you know, I was a journalist at the time, and I figured, right, listen, you know, let's do a tactical piece on this, just get it all out there. So it was a pretty roughly written half-baked piece, to be honest, but it kind of got a good reaction. So I started sort of that year taking a bit more seriously, because I suppose one of the things I've tried to do with the site since about that time, because we initially tried just being a straight-up sports site, which when you're against guys who've got full-time resources, you're just going to get killed. And something I say to all bloggers, like, is go for something that, one, you know about, and two, isn't being done. Like, if it's not got both, well, if it hasn't got the first part, you're totally toast. And if it's got the second part, you've got a really good chance of going there. So Gaelic football tactics simply wasn't an area that was being analysed anywhere at the time, and it's still very small. You'll see it in the odd regional paper here and there, but that's about it. So I saw that as sort of an avenue to go down, and sort of in 2011, the piece really took off, because it was the summer Dublin won the All-Ireland, and Donegal were sort of a controversial team at the time, and I was one of the few non-Donegal people defending them in any forum. So I sort of got a good following from both those two counties, and from there it's really, really exploded, to be honest, because I was averaging, when I started off, like, and it's like, well, sorry, when I started off, when I started the column, I was averaging 1,500 views a month. Like, these days, if I don't get 8 or 10,000, I'm annoyed, like, you know, which, and most of that growth has been in the last year, because the column became a book last year, the second book on the way, and it's like led to lots of stuff. Like I've had lots of opportunities that went up for me as a result.
But how important was it to, you know, to find that niche and to use it to establish yourself as an authority on GAA? Because you do report on a lot of club and inter-county football games, and you do travel around quite a lot to cover them.
Yeah, like I said, I fell into it by accident, but once I realised what I had, I really realised something I could run with the site. And it sort of shaped the entire way the site is now, because while that's the fundamental, that's the core part of the site, like everything else we cover, we try to go at it from a way of, well, how is it not being covered elsewhere? And again, it comes back to that fundamental thing. If the person writing isn't interested in a topic, they should not be writing about it. Like, you know, obviously there's fundamentals of writing and all that going along as well. So with the column, it's really just taken off because I was like, you know, I was on Twitter at 3 years and hadn't moved from 300 followers and stuff like that. And just, you know, getting the conversations going online on forums and message boards, which I know are a bit old school when it comes to media, but a lot of GAA fans, that's still the place they go is the message boards. And they're quite huge, like that. You're talking like, you know, several thousand members in some of these. So like, and these are the guys who want to read more. They're very voracious with their appetite for covering stuff. So I realized I'm different. These guys are looking for something different. Why not just bring it directly to them? So I was linking in message boards, which I know might seem very old school, but like that was my simple way of starting off. Just tell my audience, here, listen, this is something you haven't read before, give it a go.
And connecting with the audience was very important in kind of getting the message out there as well, and getting the coverage out there, because there, as you were saying, there was nobody was covering that kind of area in the first place until you started.
Well, like one of the classic things you see on Twitter every weekend and like even on the message boards during the week is people complain about the Sunday games coverage. Now, I'm actually one of the less ardent complainers, but that's more because I see the show as totally different to every other GAA fan. I see it as an entertainment show, but the problem is it happens to influence the media discussion in on Gaelic games, which I always find a bit odd, given like its intent clearly isn't to be a serious piece of journalism. Its intent is to be a form of light entertainment, and unfortunately happens to have a serious impact on the tone of coverage. We saw that with Donegal in 2011 in particular, because it was their game against Antrim. I know I'm getting a bit facty here for people, but they played the very first game that summer, the championship, so it was on its own on a Sunday. There was no other games to talk about, and basically it was ripped apart both in the live show and the evening show, and that set the tone for the coverage of how they played for the next year, just from one afternoon and one evening's coverage. So that's the influence they have. So when you're kind of the counter voice, like, you know, and I'm in no way an anti-establishment person, because like to me I'm not looking to, like, you know, throw it over. I'm actually looking to make it evolve, and we're starting to see that as well. Like there are local papers out there. I've seen it in Donegal, I've seen it in Kildare with the Nationalist, where they're starting to try and get tactical stuff in. And like TG Cahir had me on last week talking tactics on Show Sport, sorry, 2 weeks ago when this goes out. And that's the thing, like major media outlets are starting to realize there's an interest, because they've seen the growth and interest in what I'm doing from online. My followers have gone from 300 to 1500. It's still nothing crazy, but
enough to get a good solid following.
Exactly. Like, and I suppose one of the things is, while that's the primary thing we do, we always try to make sure, like, and me in particular, try to make sure there is the odd thing I do that isn't related to that. Like, so this week I was writing about the Boston Marathon, obviously the tragedy there. Like I write a lot in European basketball stuff, which would get a very different audience to the tactics column, but it's very good for keeping what I do fresh. And so it's good for introducing people who may not necessarily first think Gaelic football, but like, you know, and obviously European basketball especially less so, but like more general sports fans will see something like the Boston piece or other pieces I've done in the past, and they'll go, yeah, let's look around the site, and they tend to find it, because I see it from our own stats. People check around and they come back and they look at the tactics columns over and over again after that.
And from that Tactics of Passion column, you released a book there back in
October. Came out, yeah. Basically the target was the Christmas market, and hit it pretty hard. Like obviously it helped that like we got reviewed basically everywhere.
Yeah. How long did it take to put it together?
The idea sort of started getting in my head in the summer 2011, when I realized that the column was getting popular, and I was thinking, well, like, you know, it's not getting popular enough for me to get a national paper column out of it, but it's getting popular enough that like there is a niche audience there where I could sell something to. So the idea was to like look at the year in Gaelic football, like, and the definition of a year is interesting. So I went for from Sam Maguire to Sam Maguire as being the Gaelic football year, because that's how most people would follow it. Like, you'd have the autumn season of club games through the National League, which is basically
so you create a narrative of sorts.
Create a narrative, basically, and the stories themselves develop over the year. Like you'll see it. Like I divided it up looking at the different type of plays teams were using, and like sort of the different strategies, some of which are very exotic. Like, and basically, it's just trying to tell the story of the Gaelic football year.
And one of the approaches you took was that it was a self-published book. You know, there wasn't any publisher behind it. It was entirely up to you. Did you find the how did you find the process of you know, doing all of that work yourself to get the book out and also kind of promoting the book as well when it finally came?
I mean, it came natural to me, Quentin, like probably more so than going with a publisher, to be honest. Like, not that I'd be, just in case they're listening, not that I'd be opposed to a publisher dealing with me in future books, but like just because of where I was coming from with the column had been a self-started thing. And I've been self-promoting it from the start. So, like, the book was a case of, like, you know my audience better than the publisher will know them. Like, you know, I'll know how to reach them. And, you know, I had contacts in the media who I could get the book out to so I could try and get started in the reviews. So a couple of small papers took it first. Well, one national actually took it early. But they approached me, which was great. And then, like, by Christmas, like, we had a really big boost because, like, you know, it was doing well. And then I think it was the day after Stephen's Day, Vincent Hogan reviewed it, and suddenly, like, I could see the number of people clicking through to the thing went up. So yeah, he got a bottle of wine out of that. like, you know, I can assure you he wasn't bribed in advance, like, you know, but like, yeah, it was useful, to put it mildly.
And on Facebook and Twitter, when you were selling the book, like giving it to individual people, you made an effort to kind of meet people and also, you know, take photos as well. Yeah. Of giving the book. How did that help out with getting the word out there?
It was sort of a creative thing, like, because I was thinking, you know, it's in online, we'll sell X number of books, like, but I can't guarantee anything. I've got 200 books that I've got myself in person to sell. I've got a launch night, that's grand. I've got X number of friends and family that will buy it, that's grand, but I still got an awful lot of books to sell. So basically, I said to people, if you're in Dublin, you know, I can meet you in the city, wherever you want, you know, come out and buy the book. Same thing, I was going to county finals during the autumn, and I'd say to people in advance, like, you know, I'll be at this game this weekend. If you're going to be at it, hit me up on Twitter or send me an email, and I'll meet you at the game. Because, like, I use my own face and my avatar, so I'm easy to spot. So that worked great, and it's got a lot of feedback from managers. Now, obviously, it's all off the record with them, but like, they tell me what they're seeing as well, which is great. So it's helped improve the column, because one of the things I think I like about what I do is I'm not, like, you know, questioning their effort, I'm questioning their effectiveness, which, you know, is what they're far more interested in reading about, like, you know, far more than their dedication to the craft. Because if you're going out training 3 nights a week, you're trying hard, you just mightn't be getting the job done. So I'll say, why you're not getting the job done? And they respect that far more than, like, you know, questioning a man's commitment.
Yeah. And how successful was the book altogether?
Sold about 400 copies so far, and there seems to be a bit of a mini late surge for it, even though the target was Christmas. Like, I'm starting to get people querying again, because we're hitting championship season. So there could be a bit of a spurt at the start of the summer, which is kind of crazy given the next book comes out in October, you know, the sequel. So yeah, hopefully we'll get closer to 500 by the time it's finished.
Right, okay. And for anyone who is probably thinking of going down the route of self-publishing, be it sports or any other area, is there any advice you'd give?
Advice is, like, research who you're going with first. Like, go with a good name, someone you can trust. Like, I went with originalwriting.ie because I saw what they were offering on the site. Also, like, check the basics, like, you know, what they're going to charge you per page, what a word count converts into in pages. They're the boring parts.